What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is cantor Richard Cohn, the director of the Debbie Friedman School of Sacred Music at Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Too Jewish maven on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. Or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Today we begin the Jewish calendar month of Elul, last month of the Jewish year, when we begin to prepare ourselves for the coming Days of Awe, the High Holy Days. Exactly a month from now, with Rosh Hashanah beginning Sunday night, October 2nd. To remind us that tshuva, repentance and return, are more than a two-day-a-year process, we Jews sound the shofar each day of this month of Elul, awakening us to the need to reform and return to the best we can be, and to apologize to all those we've wronged or injured in the past year. Blowing shofar is a great way to wake us up. A shofar is a ram's horn. You can actually make a real horn shofar of your own. Our school children will do so in the Temple Emmanuel Religious School in a couple weeks. And with a little bit of practice, you too can blow the shofar. It's a great way to experience the urgency of the coming High Holy Days, an ancient, haunting sound, nonetheless oddly beautiful and dramatic. I brought a shofar along this morning to blow us in on this Too Jewish radio show. Well, if you weren't awake yet this morning, you should surely be so by now. To play us in this morning more elegantly on the same theme of the shofar, we begin with a setting of the classic Rosh Hashanah text, Tekaba Shofar, sound the great shofar of freedom, proclaiming liberty and gathering our exiles from the four corners of the earth. Perhaps it'll bring us to return to temple for services on this coming Rosh Hashanah in 4 weeks.
Shofar gadol echeirutenu v'sa v'sanes lekabet galuyotenu v'kabetzeinu yachad mehera me'ar batan fotaret v'yatzeinu.
That was Tekaba Shofar from my dad, Rabbi and Cantor Baruch Kohan, for the coming High Holy Days and the season of the shofar. It's also Labor Day weekend, and during a busy time of year, this marks the only real pause in a fall full of activity, since we rabbis and cantors are now working overtime preparing for the coming High Holy Days. It's wonderful to have a celebration of labor this weekend. While you prepare for barbecues, concerts, and such, enjoy the last real workday off before Thanksgiving. So here's a bit about a holiday that has special meaning for Jews. Long before it became an excuse for a three-day weekend, Labor Day was a significant statement about the value of a human being's hard work. When it started, the concept that labor had value, morally and economically, was controversial. In America, Labor Day was created in the 1880s as a way to celebrate and support the working man and working woman. It was a way to demonstrate that labor mattered, that capital wasn't the only value in the economy and society, something we still have to explain to people. We Jews have always believed labor has moral quality. A great statement in Pirkei Avot, the Mishnah tractate, The Ethics of Our Ancestors, says, Al shlosha devarim ha'olam omeid, al ha'torah ve'al ha'avodah ve'al gemilut chasadim. The world is based on three things, on Torah, on labor, and on acts of selfless kindness. The Hebrew word avodah, labor, primarily means practical, prosaic work as we know it, but it also implies divine service. The connection of labor to service to God is intentional. For Jews, honest work is an important form of prayer. This exaltation of basic labor as a foundation of society, even a way to serve God, is very Jewish. It should come as no surprise that many of the great organizers of labor in history have been Jews, that a movement based on exalting work, the labor Zionists, settled and created the State of Israel and formed much of its culture. Here in America, important names in labor, from Samuel Gompers to Emma Goldman, were Jewish. So as you enjoy Too Jewish today, enjoy the day off of labor tomorrow, and remember that it's the workers who built our country and support our society. Those who do the hard work deserve respect and honor and should be treated as equals. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish, Cantor Richard Cohen, is the director of the Debbie Friedman School of Sacred Music at Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion in New York, which produces cantors for the Reform Movement and the Jewish world. Find out what it takes to be a cantor in today's synagogue when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
It's everything you wanted to know about Judaism but were afraid to ask. Temple Emmanuel's Taste of Judaism program is now in its 17th year and explores Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on Jewish spirituality, values, and community. This free introductory class taught by our rabbis is immensely popular throughout southern Arizona. 6,000 students have enjoyed Taste to date, and you can too. In partnership with the Tucson Hebrew Academy, Taste of Judaism brings to life Jewish culture, history, rituals, and practice. It'll help you rediscover your roots or simply satisfy your curiosity about Judaism. Classes are free and open to all and include Jewish snacks. We have daytime and evening classes in Central, Northwest, and East Tucson, and this year at Splendido as well. The whole family can learn at the Taste of Judaism family class, starting soon. It's free with no fees or obligations, but space is limited and pre-registration is required. Call Mila at 327-4501 or email Mila, M-I-L-A, at teTucson.org. That's Taste of Tucson, 520-327-4501.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Cantor Richard Cohen is the director of the Debbie Friedman School of Sacred Music of Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion in New York, which creates, ordains cantors in the Reform Movement. He became director in July of 2015, so a little more than a year on the job. Spent 34 years of service to the Reform communities, most recently the Cantor at Temple Emmanuel in Dallas, Texas, one of the flagship congregations. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. I'm really thrilled to be here.
So the School of Sacred Music has a long history, but it has not always produced the same kind of cantors. What changes have you seen in the course of your career as a cantor and now heading the School of Sacred Music?
Well, the entire expectation set of cantors, I would say, has modulated. I think the cantors have always done the things that we now do, but the emphasis has been placed so much more greatly on certain areas. So In our program at HUCJR, our cantorial students are learning to be wonderful pastors. They're learning to be well-prepared educators. They're learning to be community leaders. They're learning how to integrate their leadership style with their pulpit style, with their organizational acumen. And so it's really an all-encompassing, multidimensional clergy position. These things were always implied, and depending on where you served, might more or less be in effect. But now it's an expectation of congregations that cantors will be prepared in all of those areas and more.
It used to be there were wonderful people that were interviewed for positions who had great personalities and lots of skills in different areas, and they hired the person with the best voice. Not so much anymore.
Well, here's the thing. Congregations are still expecting a high standard of ability to communicate through music. So it means that although interviewing committees are very interested in all the areas I just named, they figure that our ordinees are going to appear with significant capabilities in singing and repertory selection and service leadership. And in most ways, those are still our highest priorities, because without them, people really can't make a strong claim on the distinctive quality of being cantors.
You know, it's fascinating to me to see the kind of multi-instrumentalists, the remarkable musical accomplishment that some of the cantors have coming out now. Maybe we'll explore some of that more when we return with cantor Richard Cohn, who's the head of the Debbie Friedman School of Sacred Music at HUC, in just a moment here on Too Jewish. We welcome our friends David and Pamela from Freedom Smoke. Good morning.
Hey,
good morning.
Rabbi.
Quitting smoking, big part of your lives.
Yeah, it's very important. When we started this company just over 6 years ago, it was because I had a really bad cigar habit, and it was time for me to quit. We have 7 children. Our youngest just turned 8, and I wish to be around to watch them all grow up and have successful careers and family of their own.
And Pamela, it's better personally, isn't it?
Yeah, most definitely. I'm a non-smoker, and being with a person who smokes cigars in particular, it's much nicer. It doesn't, his body doesn't reek of it, his hair does not reek of it, his clothes do not smell of it, and there's no tobacco between his teeth anymore.
And you don't have to send them for extra showers or
no,
out in the rain.
No extra showers.
How can people find out more about Freedom Smoke?
You can look us up on our website at freedomsmokeusa.com or call us on our toll-free number, 1-800-705-7013. That's 800-705-7013.
Thanks so much.
Thanks,
Thank
Rabbi.
You.
Know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people, an individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Cohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Cohan and A. Irma Cohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of 4 activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Cohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Cohan Foundation Award in 2016, please go to CohanAward.com, CohanAward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is CohanAward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio 18. Or visit our website at TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. The top 10 in America, Moment Magazine says.
Success is a terrible thing and a wonderful thing. If you can enjoy it, it's wonderful. If it starts eating away at you and they're waiting for more from me, or what can I do to top this? then you're in trouble.
Gene Wilder died last week after several years of suffering from Alzheimer's. Born Jerome Silberman in Milwaukee in 1933, Wilder adopted his stage name, saying he couldn't imagine a marquee reading Jerome Silberman as Hamlet. Gene Wilder was a close friend and collaborator of the Jewish director, producer, and comic maniac Mel Brooks. In addition to starring in the Brooks-directed Young Frankenstein as the American grandson of the creator of the famous monster, Wilder created the role of mild-mannered, hysterical accountant Leo Bloom in The Producers and the hard-drinking, pot-smoking gunman The Waco Kid in the satirical western Blazing Saddles. Wilder's performance in Young Frankenstein, which he originated and co-wrote with Mel Brooks, was, as one reviewer put it, a marvelous addled mixture of young Thomas Edison, Winnie the Pooh, and your average Playboy reader with a keen appreciation of beautiful bosoms. Unexpectedly, Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein were the top and fourth highest grossing movies of 1974. Gene Wilder and the late comedian Richard Pryor later teamed up in a series of black Jewish buddy movies, including Stir Crazy and Silver Streak. Wilder memorably starred as Avram Belinsky, a rabbi who befriends a bank robber played by the young Harrison Ford in the 1979 Western, well, a comedy Western, The Frisco Kid, a true Jewish classic. Wilder was married four times, including to Jewish comedian Gilda Radner in 1984. Radner tragically died of ovarian cancer in 1989. Following her death, Wilder became active in promoting cancer awareness and research, co-founded Gilda's Club, a nonprofit providing support to those affected by cancer. Gene Wilder was an incredible actor, perhaps best known for playing Willy Wonka in that classic film. Here's what he said about getting the role.
I had read the book, and Mel Stewart, the director, came to my home in New York. And he said, you want to do it? I said, well, I'll tell you, I'd like to do it if I can come out and all the crowd quiets down and I'm using a cane. Oh my God, Willy Wonka is crippled. And I walk slowly and you can hear a pin drop and my cane gets stuck in a brick and I fall over on my face and do a forward somersault and jump up and they all start to applaud. He said, Mel Stewart said, what do you want to do that for? I said, because no one will know from that point on whether I'm lying or telling the truth. He said, are you saying you won't do the film if you can't do that? I said, that's what I'm saying. Okay, let's do it. And I meant it.
As we remember the remarkable comic actor Gene Wilder, who passed away last week, we have a special guest. We welcome a very special guest with a personal connection to Gene Wilder, Alav HaShalom, my dad, Rabbi and Cantor Baruch Kohan. Good morning, Dad.
Good morning.
So how did you meet Gene Wilder and in what context?
I met him in 1979. He was cast in the lead of a picture called The Frisco Kid. In 1979, I was cantor at Temple Emmanuel of Beverly Hills, and we had two rabbis, Meyer Heller and Stephen Robbins. The story of Frisco Kid, of course, involves a yeshiva bacher from Poland who comes out on the bottom of his class and therefore isn't considered really qualified to lead a congregation there. So the yeshiva sends him to a place that nobody ever heard of before called San Francisco. And it involves how he arrives in America and loses all his possessions and he has to make it on foot across the country to San Francisco. And it's a very fun, real fun picture, a lot of comedy involved. And at that time, as I said, I was at Temple Emmanuel, and Mace Neufeld, the producer of the Frisco Kid, was a member of our congregation. So he hired Rabbi Heller, Rabbi Robbins, and myself as technical advisors on this picture. They had to review the script or whatever else they had to do, and my job was to teach Gene Wilder all the davening he had to do, which was quite a hefty job. Gene, of course, was Jewish. Even the L.A. Times, which ignored this picture completely in its write-up, maybe that has something to say about the bias of the L.A. Times, but anyway, they had to list his original name as Silberman. So, you know, we knew he was Jewish, but at that time, I would say he probably didn't get into a synagogue since his own bar mitzvah. So it was quite a job. But interestingly enough, I have a book called Stars of Day David came out many years later, in which they interviewed Jewish film stars, and he was one of them. And he mentioned the Frisco Kid, and he mentioned the technical advisor. He said, the Cantor was the best one because he gave me tapes.
You know, I remember you saying you sat down with Gene Wilder, you know, introduced each other, talked a little bit, and you said, well, Gene, you know, like, what do you remember in terms of Jewish prayers? He says, I didn't remember the words, but I remember the melody. And of course, Wilder sang very well. The melody went, for what I did, went something like this. Da 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 dee, da 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 da. You know, he remembered his Haftorah from his bar mitzvah.
Yeah, that's true. What happened was there was a scene in the Old Country before he leaves for America. There was a scene in the picture where he's skating on a pond outside the yeshiva, and the director asked him, well, could you sing something while you're skating there, some old folk song or something? And he brought up this melody, and the director turns to me, and I asked Gene, I said, you know what you're singing, Gene? He said, no. I said, that's your Haftorah. He got tears in his eyes. It was important to him. So it was an interesting little episode. I'm glad you remembered that.
Yeah, I also remember you invited me. I was in college. You invited me to come to the set of Frisco Kid. I met Mace Neufeld, who was a member of your temple and brought you into this, and met Gene Wilder and Harrison Ford, who was partly Jewish too. And it was a very, very interesting kind of place to be.
That's right. As I said, it was a lot of different comedy scenes came into it. For example, where he wakes up one morning out on the road, and there's a man bending over him wearing a black suit and a black hat, and Gene looks at him and he says, Lanzmann. The guy turns out to be Amish.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? It was a little extra laugh there.
Well, Dad, thanks for that memory of Gene Wilder. May his memory be a blessing, and we'll talk soon.
All right, Simcha, I'm glad to talk with you. And you know that your brother Jonathan shot a picture of Gene and myself sitting at a table on the set. And I still have that picture in my bookcase, so take a look at it next time you come.
I remember it well. Thanks. Take care.
You too.
A final comment from Gene Wilder in The Frisco Kid about God.
When we're suffering, he gives us compassion when all that we feel is hatred. He gives us courage when we're searching around blindly like little mice in the darkness. But he does not make rain. Of course, sometimes just like that. He'll change his mind.
We have about 2 months to go until we elect a new president of these United States. We continue our 2016 to Jewish Presidential Report. A strange and sad coda to the Anthony Weiner debacle crept into the presidential campaign last week. The unfortunately named Weiner, a former New York congressman whose rising career was torpedoed by a notorious sexting scandal about 5 years ago. He is married to Huma Abedin, one of Hillary Clinton's top aides. Abedin announced last week that they are now separating after yet another Weiner sexting incident, this time with what may have been a Donald Trump supporter who went public with it. They have a young son who was visible in one of Weiner's sexting photos. In a word, yuck. Weiner, of course, is Jewish, but not one Jew we are exactly proud of. Donald Trump alleged that Weiner must have had access to classified information, and this demonstrated bad judgment on Hillary Clinton's part. Well, there is certainly enough bad judgment to go around in this story, most of it Anthony Weiner's, some of it Abedin's, in staying with him this long. In a year when much of the presidential reporting is unappetizing, this perhaps creates a new low. Just 2 months left. That was our 2016 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish community, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Terrorism is very much on everybody's mind, or if it's not this week, it certainly will be by next week, the 15th anniversary of 9/11. So many changes in these 15 years, but it seems as though terrorism has become, if anything, more established, stronger, state-oriented, like so many changes.
I agree, although I'm not sure about the term state-oriented. I think terrorism is almost by definition practiced by non-state entities. And if you want to look at examples of state-sponsored terrorism, the classic one is our use of atomic weapons near the end of World War II in order to shorten the war and ultimately save millions of lives. We terrorized both the Japanese civilian population and the Japanese government into a surrender that they would otherwise have found unthinkable. And sure enough, within 30 days of that first dreadful use of atomic weapons, the war was over. But that was state-sponsored terrorism, if ever there was. I mean, it was inducing terror to accomplish a political objective.
Well, you could also say the Nazi Blitz was the same basic idea, it just didn't work.
Right, but that was more military to military. I don't know. But in any case, I think most of the terrorism that we see today is conducted by non-state entities, which is why our government and other Western governments have such a tough time fighting it, because we're used to fighting states and armies and governments, and we're not used to fighting individuals who may be loners or maybe part of a loosely organized group, but who aren't negotiating partners at a table and don't have all the trappings of a government. So we're really not used to dealing with terrorist organizations or groups or enemies or individuals. You know, and one example of how a lot depends on your perspective is the guy who assassinated the Archduke Franz Ferdinand in the shot that eventually led to World War I was a man named Gavrilo Princip, who was an ethnic Serb, basically acting on his own, although he belonged to a small group called the Black Hand. He was not an agent of a state. He caused the First World War, which some would argue led inevitably to the Second. Tremendous amount of carnage. But he, as clearly as he was seen as a terrorist by many Western governments at the time, was also seen as a freedom fighter and a revolutionary and a hero by many people who considered themselves oppressed by colonial empires, like that of Austro-Hungary or that of the Ottoman Turks or that of France or that of Britain, for that matter. And he was seen as striking a blow for liberty and fundamental human rights. So even today, I think a lot depends on one's perspective. What we call a terrorist might in someone else's eyes be a freedom fighter. So I think it's important to remember that.
We will remember that. But I think when we come back next week, let's talk about things like ISIS and some of the unexpected results of terror.
Right, and more generally what's going on in the Arab world.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
Look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivinan, Israel Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Israel does some remarkable things that don't get publicized very much for people that no one else is helping. You have an incredible story about a child from Afghanistan who needed a heart operation.
Yes, and so this organization called Save a Child Heart, and it's mainly designed, like I think 10 years ago or so, we just visited this organization and hospital when I was with a JCC group last year in November, and we met, you know, the doctors, and we saw the facility and the rehabilitation center for the kids after the operation, with the surgery. And this organization, Israeli organization, saved already 4,000 kids from 51 different countries, mainly Muslim kids, mainly from countries that we don't have any foreign relationship, any relationship. And sometimes it's the last Ezra Achrona, like the last one that they will call will be Israel,
yeah,
to save their kids. You know, they will do anything.
Out of desperation, they'll go anywhere else first, but they finally turn to Israel.
So
last resort, we would
say. Bidiuk. So the recent story is from Afghanistan, 14-month kid, like a baby,
right.
Just came with his father, a florist from Afghanistan that, you know, heard about Israel and about this program from an Israeli teacher from Haifa that used to teach Hebrew in Afghanistan
Wow.
for an American foreign ministry, like. And then a friend of her, that he's relative of the family, contacted her through Facebook, and then they contacted the organization called Save a Child Heart, and they, together with the Israeli government, of course, made all the arrangement to bring the father and the kid, and he was treated already. And I saw a YouTube, a few seconds on Google, seeing the kids running in the rehabilitation center.
So the boy after the heart operation is now up to running, and he's doing fine.
Done. And he was embraced by the Israeli community, and especially by Afghanistan, you know, Jewish from Afghanistan.
Jews from Afghanistan, because there's an ancient Jewish community now, most of course, probably all in Israel.
Yeah, and they made Aliyah, so they embraced the family and helped the father. And during the time that the kid and the father was here, the mom in Afghanistan gave birth for another kid.
To another child. Wow.
So mazal tov.
So the truth is that, there are people from all of the Muslim countries who are being treated. I think you said something like 4,000.
4,000 kids, and from 51 different countries.
Most of them Islamic.
Yeah, and I know it's not the main goal of the program, but at least I know that you will join me, and we will hope that these new hearts that was treated in Israel will bring, you know, different message to their community.
Yeah, I think of the prophetic message, a Lev Chadash from Ezekiel. I'll give you a new heart and maybe a new relationship with Israel.
Nachon.
Thanks so much, Ashrat. We'll talk next week. Rabbi.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Jarrow Psychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Jarrow Psych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Jarrow Psychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, head of the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Good morning. Boker Tov.
Boker Or. We talked last week about mission statements and the values, the whole process that goes into figuring out what makes a Jewish community educational institution like Tucson Hebrew Academy, mm-hmm. a community day school, appropriate, and how you figure out what you're going to do. So you went through an elaborate process to figure out what everybody needed, wanted, what their goals and ideals were, what their own values were.
Yeah.
Then you formulated a mission, not a mission statement, but really a...
We put words to it.
So tell us how that worked out.
It's worked out really, really well. And I love the product that came out of the process, because it talks about who we are as Tucson Hebrew Academy and what we do. And, you know, every organization has to be able to communicate that to people so that the community is focused and moving in a very specific direction, so that people that don't know the community can quickly learn, oh, this is what you guys stand for. This is what's important here. And I like to think of the product in terms of a Star of David. So if you could kind of visualize.
Sounds like Franz Rosenzweig, the Star of Redemption, right?
Okay. You'll have to teach me about that sometime. But so in the center of the star is the mission and what we do, our vision. So in the center is providing exemplary education through stimulating rigorous academics, inspired Jewish values, and an engaged supportive community. And we also state that we are our community's Jewish day school. And then we include what do, which is a statement about when students are finished through the THA experience, what are they capable of? And then on the points of the star, we have six core values. Children, the first value and most important. That's why school exists. Commitment to excellence, community, living Judaism, supporting Israel, and tikkun olam. So each of those points helps to really fulfill the mission and flesh out, give more depth and body to the things that we stand for and why we do what we do at THA.
Do you ever feel too tightly bound by aspects of going through this process?
Not at all. In fact, it's important as you do a process like this to be inclusive, because that's where people get engaged, that's where people get fired up and passionate, and that's where you get
people's buy-in. There's much more traction in a community when the community builds these statements and the community identifies its values together than those things that are imposed on them or that they, you know, built a long time ago and now they're coming on board. So there's a real sense of passion and being behind on supporting the mission through a process like that.
Sounds like a great process. And boy, those six values, you could apply them to almost any Jewish organization and come up with, that wouldn't be a bad model for anyone.
Thank you.
We will talk next week.
All right. Looking forward to it.
Thanks, John. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Moshe, an elderly man, was listening to a dietitian address a large audience. "Did you know," said the dietitian, "that the stuff we put into our stomachs eventually kills most of us?" "It's true. Red meat is terrible for you. Soft drinks erode your stomach lining. Chinese food is full of monosodium glutamate. And most of you don't realize the long-term harm being caused by chlorine in our drinking water. But as bad as these are, one thing is worse than all of them put together, and we've all eaten it or will eat it. Can anybody here tell me what food causes the most grief and suffering for years after eating it?" Moshe stands up and says, "Wedding cake." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion from Deuteronomy is called Shoftim, Judges. It establishes a process for the administration of justice, and it includes one of the most powerful statements in all religious, philosophical, or ethical tradition. Tzedek, tzedek tirdof, justice, justice, you shall pursue. In the Torah, which has no extra words, a repetition of a word means that it has additional importance and power. Here the word for justice, tzedek, is repeated, emphasizing justice is extraordinarily significant. We must be not only fair in life, but truly just. Even more than that, the Torah teaches that we must not only be just, but tirdof, pursue justice, chase it, make it a goal for our own lives and our civilization. It's not enough to act well in a place where justice is not the norm. We must strive to change an unjust situation into a just one. Tzedek, tzedek tirdof, each of us must pursue true justice. It's easy to understand that for Jews, justice underlies everything good in a society. Without justice, there's no peace. Without justice, there's no morality. Without justice, we simply can't trust our leaders and our government to act well. In our society, we've been repeatedly reminded that on racial issues, injustice in America still remains. We must continue to work seriously to rectify this, to pursue justice. Be just, God commands. Don't accept injustice as a permanent condition. Seek, no, chase justice in your life. Work for justice in your society. Then good will come. It's a great and holy message in a society like ours, in which the pursuit of happiness sometimes seems to be the ultimate goal. The better pursuit, indeed the most meaningful real pursuit, is justice. May our actions and our words help make our society more just in this coming week. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest, cantor Richard Cohn, director of the Debbie Friedman School of Sacred Music at Hebrew Union College in New York, will explain what's so different about being a cantor today and what the job prospects are, which is surprising. Find out when we return here on Too Jewish.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through eighth grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, thaaz.org, 529-3888.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
A depressing story from my alma mater, UCLA, that typifies the large and growing problem that the neo-fascist BDS movement is creating on college campuses across America today. Even professing neutrality on the subject of Israel and the Palestinians is now considered a crime. After a long, tedious, and unfair struggle with anti-Israel harassment from administrators and student members of the Boycott the Vest and Sanctions, the BDS movement at UCLA, a former graduate student body president has decided to leave the law school there in search of a less hostile learning environment. Former UCLA law student and Graduate Student Association president Milan Chatterjee, a Hindu Indian American, has been the object of bullying and public attack since he refused to allocate campus funds to an event that either promoted or rejected support for the State of Israel. Chatterjee's viewpoint neutrality policy stated that topics surrounding Israel were irrelevant to the nature of campus politics, and campus funding should not be directed to take sides on such measures. The Students for Justice in Palestine, an anti-Israel hate group really, responsible for leading a smear campaign against Chatterjee, responded with a plethora of threatening legal documents, administrative efforts, and media allegations. They painted Chatterjee as a biased student body president and called for his resignation. They enlisted the help of Palestine Legal and the ACLU to send lawyers after Chatterjee to intimidate him and to push UCLA's administration to launch a detailed investigation of his actions. The allegations were debunked, but that did not stop anti-Israel activists from publishing personal attacks in the Daily Bruin newspaper and on the internet. Worse, the UCLA administration did nothing to protect Chatterjee. Instead, Vice Chancellor for Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion, Jerry Kang, aided the SJP by taking part in its investigations and the harassment directed at the grad student president and releasing supposedly confidential findings on the internet. In a letter to UCLA Chancellor Gene Block, Chatterjee revealed his decision to complete his final year of law school at NYU, saying, "The hostile and unsafe campus environment I am facing at UCLA has left me with no choice but to move away from this university." He then detailed all of the problems and the lack of support the administration had provided. Chatterjee is now suing UCLA. Frankly, I hope he wins. When a Hindu grad student body president tries to keep the issue of Israel and the Palestinians off the agenda because it's irrelevant to his organization's work, he is personally trashed by individuals and organizations and left defenseless by a great university. Wow. Chatterjee received a Courage Award from the American Jewish Congress back in June. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world.
Delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Cantor Richard Cohen, became the director of the Debbie Friedman School of Sacred Music at Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion a little over a year ago, following 34 years of service to Reform communities, most recently and notably the Cantor of Temple Emmanuel in Dallas, Texas. He had a long tenure at North Shore Congregation Israel in Glencoe, Illinois, in the Chicago area, in which he served not only as a cantor, but did a remarkable array of performing work as well, including singing Ernst Bloch's Avodat HaKodesh, the Sacred Service, which I got a chance to sing once, but not with the same orchestras. Cantor Cohen, in the process of selecting someone to be a cantor, what does HUC look for that might be surprising?
Oh, that might be surprising. Well, I don't think people would be surprised that we expect strong musicianship skills and a background in Hebrew studies. We certainly have those expectations. Repertory that people have prepared and the ability to present that repertory compassionately and with inspiration. I think that what might be somewhat surprising and moving to me are the essays that students write in support of their candidacy. So these essays, we ask students to write an essay on a Torah portion. And it's interesting to learn about their lives through that medium. Inevitably, in every case, a student chooses something from the Torah that really mirrors an important part of their personal development, and we learn about who they are as human beings and as communicators through those means. It's really very, very telling. We also like to know, you know, kind of where they stand in relationship to the Jewish world, to Reform and Progressive Judaism, and so forth. And so they really are being interviewed as whole persons and not only as musicians.
It used to be a stereotype that the cantor and the rabbi never got along. That's a very knowing laugh, Richard.
Yeah, I've had such great relationships with rabbinical colleagues, and of course here in New York, where rabbinical and cantorial students study together, we have very strong, close partnerships. But I mean, in my career, it's just been a dream of wonderful collaborations among rabbis and cantors, because we've, I think, developed a lexicon for conversation and a kind of a way of relating to each other that emphasizes commonality and that allows us to set our goals and objectives together, so that what the work we're doing in liturgy and public prayer and in education can really be aligned with each other. There's no need for us to be you know, in any way at different poles of the spectrum. Everybody's working toward the same outcome.
It's also an interesting phenomenon in recent, I guess even decades, that we find rabbis and cantors married to each other.
Yes. I don't know. I'm laughing every time. So we had a number of couples last year who were ordained around the same time, and, you know, it makes for an interesting set of choices, right? Because they're seeking work in nearby communities to one another. It's also very beautiful what happens, and the sense of closeness in the school gives rise to a lot of those relationships, and it's because people have shared spiritual aspirations in addition to just being compatible with each other.
Cantorial training is vocal training to a great degree. You know, you have to have not always a classically trained voice, pretty much. There's a kind of assumption that cantors will also play, say, guitar now. How much of a factor is that in the kinds of choices that the School of Sacred Music makes? What do you recommend to people that are thinking about it?
Well, that's a great question, and our faculty's really been engaged with that topic lately. I think we're moving toward feeling like cantorial students, by the time they're ordained, really need a degree of mastery in either guitar or piano, that they're called upon in so many ways to engage with other instrumentalists, other musicians, and need to understand the music-making part of what happens with keyboard artists and others. We do insist on guitar for all of our students if they haven't had significant backgrounds in guitar. I mean, we have students who just came back from Jerusalem and are here in New York for their second year of school who've been song leading and composing songs and, you know, have very high facility with guitar already. All students take guitar in the second and third years of the program, and we have thresholds of expectation for them to achieve, and we find that it's a really valuable liturgical skill, not just because they can play the guitar, but because they can communicate with that instrument in a way that helps congregations feel closer to one another. So that's what we're really after, is not just somebody who's got the ability to play the chords and pick out the strumming patterns, but actually pray with the instrument.
The process of being a cantor or becoming a cantor, sometimes it's a choice that a kid makes when they're, you know, they first see a cantor singing. Sometimes it's somebody who started in opera or musical theater. What is the background of most of the, or song leader, what's the background of most of the entering students? And do you find that there's any sort of greater advantage to one background or another musically?
It's interesting. I don't think there is an advantage right now. I think we have students from all those streams, and you've really got your finger on the pulse. Our students are either from classical music or from music theater or from Judaic studies with music interest or from singer-songwriting background. So they come in from different streams, but they're flowing together rather nicely. I'm thinking about the class that just returned from Jerusalem, and it's a real mix of people with operatic or other classical music experience, and some of them very, very deep song leading backgrounds, but they're all highly skilled musicians, and I think that's what evens it out. In other words, it's not so much from where you have come, but how effectively you are able to express yourself through that medium. And so during the 5 years that people are in school, they have ample time to amplify the areas of their artistry that were not so much in their backgrounds. And you see that even out, and sometimes by the fourth year it becomes striking. And it's one of the assets of having a program that's as thorough as ours, is that there's sufficient time and sufficient nurture for all of these capabilities to come out. And then you find that students by their fifth year are able to exhibit the salient qualities of each genre that you would hope a cantor would be able to represent these days.
So a kind of difficult question. Economic times have not always been so great, starting with the recession in the late 2000s. Congregations often have to make choices about where they're putting their resources. Has this put strain on the cantorate in the larger sense?
Well, the interesting thing is that in the world of cantorial placement, upon ordination, there really has not been any kind of significant interruption in employment. So there are actually more positions in the reform movement right now than we have been able to fill, and virtually every person ordained is successfully being placed in a pulpit. So I would say that right now there's great strength in the reform cantorate as it relates to the marketplace of congregational life, if I can use that phrase. And congregations are really thirsting for extremely well-qualified cantors. So our goal is to educate those students to become those cantors, to fill those positions. And I think that as long as we're able to cultivate that kind of cantorial presence, there will be positions for them in the reform movement, even increasingly so. And that's the truth on the ground. I mean, I'm not really exaggerating this at all. Placement has been strong. There was a little bit, of a kind of a narrow passage around the time of the recession when there were changes in congregations. But things are much more stable now, and the demand for cantors seems to continue to be strong.
A final quick question. There have been other means for people to become cantors in the Reform Movement. I know you're head of the School of Sacred Music. Are there such paths available for musical professionals and synagogues who are trying to find their way into the cantorate?
Well, that's a great question. We have a certification program for cantors. There were six cantors who became certified last spring, and there are five still in the program here at HUCJR. We're studying that program carefully right now to see whether we feel like we can sustain it over time. People have to be extremely well qualified in order to join a distance learning program like that. There is some on-campus experience, but we really designed it for people with very substantial backgrounds as soloists in congregations. So I'd say we're in an exploratory stage of how effectively that can be sustained going forward. And I mean, other than that, formally within the movement itself, there's not another structure. And I think that in partnership with the American Conference of Cantors, we're going to continue to look at whether there could and should be other avenues to credentialing as cantors.
I want to thank Cantor Richard Cohn for a great visit here on Too Jewish. You can find out more information at huc.edu and just look for cantors. Is there another place people can go for more information?
Oh, that's really the place to go. you know, on the front page is an easy link to the cantorial program.
Richard, thanks so much.
Oh, I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Our pleasure. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. We have a special show on Too Jewish for the 15th anniversary of 9/11. Our guest will be Professor William Potter, the leading expert on nuclear nonproliferation, talking about the dangers of nuclear weapons and terrorism in the post-9/11 world. Our playout this morning comes from the late, great Gene Wilder. Pure imagination, as he exemplified in his comic acting. May his rest be in peace. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Come with me, and you'll be in a world of pure imagination.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.